BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutan, and with me, Brian Fernandez. Good morning. It's the start of a new week. Today's the 12th of March 2018. We're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning. Remember, you can always join in this conversation by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899 or tweeting us at BFM Radio. Brian, how was your weekend? Was it good?
Good, unfortunately, quite busy, just lots of family around and stuff, so just running around a lot.
Okay, wonderful. I guess that's what a lot of people do on the weekends. They catch up with all the things they've had to put aside during the work week. Now, quite a few things happened over the weekend. Let's just run down some of them. Brian, we can start with Japan and Mount Shinmo Dake, which has been spewing ash for days, but eruptions turned explosive on Saturday, and it's being dubbed the James Bond volcano. Not just for the fact that, you know, giant boulders are now shooting out from the top of the mountain, but because of some films being shot around there.
Because in 1967,
I think You Only Live Twice was shot there, I think. And, you know, the bad guy's lair was basically the backdrop of the Mount Shinodake is basically the backdrop
for the lair of the evil guy. I loved James Bond's, many evil people, including the man with the golden gun who had an extra nipple, if you remember. That was an interesting, that's a kind of factoid you probably have forgotten.
And if you go far back, you'd also remember Jaws. That's the character that always sticks in my mind.
Yes, right. Not a shark, but a very large human being with, I think, metallic teeth. Now, also, we've just seen China Xi Jinping becoming president for life, potentially, as the term limits were removed and parliament passed that act.
Yeah, so out of 2,964 votes, there were actually two dissenting votes and also three abstentions.
Oh, fascinating to see what
brave people.
What's going to happen with them as a consequence? I wonder if the vote was secret. Also, citizens in the Estonian district or an Estonian district, because Estonia is part of the Baltics. It's one of the three Baltic nations, Lithuania and Latvia being the others, have chosen cannabis leaf as a symbol of their new flag and their coat of arms.
Now, so this is interesting because cannabis is illegal in Estonia, but government officials have said that basically nobody's going to stand in the way of the local authorities if they want to use it as their symbol.
Yeah, I think it's got to do in part with the name of the district. The name of the district is similar to the word for cannabis in the Estonian language. So perhaps that's another cultural reason why they have established that as their flag and coat of arms. Interesting that even districts have coat of arms. Now, we'll be back with a look at Canadian doctors who are protesting a pay rise for themselves. They want that money used for better services and for nurses. Go figure. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Rod Stewart and his 1971 hit, Maggie May. I'm Sharad Kutan, with me, Brian Fernandez, and it is the 12th of March, 2018. We're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning. We're going to begin with a story of doctors in the Canadian province of Quebec, who have shocked the world by turning down a pay rise. Would anyone turn down a pay rise? I asked myself. Apparently, these doctors from Quebec have a simple answer to the question why they're doing it. And apparently, it revolves around patient care.
Yeah, so here's the thing. One of the challenges of the system is, so if you look at the Canadian healthcare system itself, it's universal healthcare. There's access compared to the US, for example. So it's a user pays kind of model. So the challenge is that the system is burdened because there's not enough resources for nurses, for example. The nurses are all overburdened. But at the same time, physicians have had a doubling of their salaries over the last 10 years. So I think that the challenge is really in terms of what they are trying to do is really to push those dollars that they could be earning towards more patient care in terms of more resources for nurses, for example, so that you could have better care for individual
patients.
That's
fascinating, right? So apparently the new proposed pay rises would add an additional 1.5 billion Canadian dollars to the budget by 2023. And these, some 700 physicians, both GPs and specialists, signed a petition entitled Quebec Doctors for the Public Regime, rejecting the pay rise. They said they, as you said, Brian, rather it go to patient care and services. The question is, I mean, just coming back to us, I mean, without a reference to the Canadian, health system, is the idea of rejecting something that will benefit you personally, but for the greater good. Do you think something like that could happen in a country like ours?
I think it depends on your income level. If you're in a very high income bracket, 1.8% or 1.5% increase in your pay packet is not going to make a huge material benefit to you. You'd probably go... You may think and say, hey, if you could be persuaded to forego that rise for the greater good. But if you're on minimum wage, if you're earning 1,000 ringgit or 1,500 ringgit, every cent counts.
So no, I think that's a very good point. I mean, if the question is the relative sacrifice that you're making, right? So as you're saying, if somebody is lower down the salary scale, the wage scale, the sacrifice is greater for those on higher. But I wonder if that's all that's animating these doctors, if that's their entire motivation.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, the Canadian healthcare system is a unique one. So compared to as I said, the US, it's a user pay model. So not everyone has equal access. In Canada, however rich you are, if you're a guy from the street or if you're a really rich person, you have same access to the healthcare system. So in order to achieve that sort of system, there are trade-offs. And one of the trade-offs is obviously in terms of resources, So you the allocation of resources, you've only got a finite amount. So how do you allocate
that? Yeah, so what's fascinating is just the difference between the situation for doctors and the situation for nurses. According to an independent report commissioned by Quebec's Health and Welfare Commissioner, it found that, as you pointed out just now, physician salaries have doubled over the past 10 years, while hours doctors spent with patients have declined. So their overall situation or working conditions have improved, whereas for nurses, it's actually gotten worse. And the question is, what kind of public policies informed this situation? Why is it that it's become worse for nurses, but so much better for doctors?
So one of the things with the doctors is they were traditionally paid lower. And even now, the average pay for doctors is only 250 or 280,000 Canadian dollars. There's a range for that, which when you think about it, for a society like that, for all the years that you have to study, and then their compliance cost as well, which in the same article talks about after compliance cost, their actual income is probably closer to, to 150 to 180,000. So really, they're not high income earners as we would think they would be.
Okay, we'll be back with a look at plundered art and whether it should be returned. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was U2 with Without You. It's a 1987 hit, part of the Joshua album tree. I'm Sharad Kutan, with me, Brian Fernandez. You remember 1987? Were you around?
Well, I certainly was. And, I'm from that generation where YouTube just, was an unknown band and then just rocketed, across the world. And it's just amazing how much money they're still making. After all these years, I read, Sharad, that, last year they went on tour. It was the 30th anniversary of the Joshua Tree. The tour grossed $316 million, 2.7 million tickets sold. And it was the highest grossing tour. So look at, it's not a boy band or whatever. It's actually U2, which was the biggest grossing tour last year.
Okay, so you're suggesting, because in the 80s we were making great music and everything has been in sharp decline since.
No, I think...
Actually, except that the Beatles were a boy band. You must admit, they were the boy band of their time.
Of their time. But no, the thing is, actually, Sharad, on the contrary, I think that because we've all matured and maybe people are, have a little bit more disposable income, they're able to go for all these tours.
Ah, right. So in that case, everybody from Engelbert Humperdinck should... onwards should be cashing it in. Now, let's move on to the story that we promised to talk about, which is about bringing plundered art back home. Now, French President Emmanuel Macron is acting on a promise he made last year to repatriate artworks taken from the continent of Africa by French colonists. He recently appointed two experts to draw up recommendations on how to carry out the restitution process. The two are expected to deliver their report in November. The question is, is this just and fair, or are there real challenges in this process of restitution?
I think one of the key challenges, just from an operational standpoint, is this. Because many of these artworks around, and let's use, so we're talking about colonialism, so let's say spread out across European countries, they've been in these museums, they've been very well looked after, curated, and so forth.
We assume.
We've got to ask ourselves also, if you return this to the home countries, will they also, be looked after correctly? B, also, will people have access to it that are not from Africa? One of the advantages of having them in Europe currently is the fact that, obviously, whether you're a Chinese tourist or you're a Malaysian tourist, you have access to African art.
Only if you're a tourist and you have the kind of disposable cash that allows you to go to Europe for a holiday. But, you know, there are many people who don't have that, and especially in the developing world, who would benefit from those artworks or objects returned to their home country, right?
Yeah, so I think that there has to be really a managed process of returning this. The returning could be several forms. One, it could be obviously just giving it back to them. The other way of returning it, in quotes, is really to loan it over extended periods of time, which is very common in artwork.
But who owns it? I mean, I think that this is a sore point with lots of nationalists. You say, well, if you stole
you
it
from... You stole it in the first place, right?
Yeah, then you should return it. Now, the issue might be less emotional if the object is something, inanimate, like a pot or a sword or something like that. But in fact, people have also been made part of museums. If you remember the very famous case of the Hottentot Venus, who was a woman who actually traveled in a circus in Europe, and eventually, when she died, she was mummified and put on display. Now, this would be horrifying if it was one of your relatives, if your ancestors were mummified and kept in a museum in Europe. You might say, well, actually, I think she deserves a
proper burial. At home.
Yeah, so okay, so that's the emotional end of the spectrum. But the question is something that is stolen in the past really yours to claim now? I mean, that is the, you know, it would be quite simple if it was an issue of you having your goods stolen. But if it was your ancestors and somebody else's ancestors, are they obliged to now...
But it's about rights of ownership at the end of the day, as a country, as a nation.
What about the jewel in the crown? What about the Koh-i-Noor, you know, in the British crown? I think, would you think the, you know, Queen Elizabeth of Britain should have those jewels stolen from very many parts of Asia returned to their rightful owner?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's just an extremely complicated discussion there in terms of how
maybe they can switch the diamonds for something cheaper like topaz, which they can buy in the open market,
or you exchange it for some mineral rights or something like that.
Okay, now taking us up to the first bulletin of the morning, we have Cream with Sunshine of Your Love. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Fleetwood Mac, and everywhere, their 1987 hit. Brian Fernandez and myself, Sharad Kutan, with you on the morning run. We're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock. It is the 12th of March, and remember, you can always be part of this conversation by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899 or tweeting us at BFM Radio. Did you know Chaka Khan does a version of this song in 1996? I didn't know that.
I didn't know that. But you know, again, Fleetwood Mac is one of those groups that just has a lot of longevity, like YouTube. So this
and you and tour. Me, we both have longevity on our sides too.
Do you know they've sold over 100 million records since they started?
Extraordinary, extraordinary. Okay, according to a recent report by consulting firm McKinsey on student performance in Asia, Malaysian students are the happiest and most relaxed. Now, this might come as a shock to parents driving your kids to school right now, who might be a little sleepy. creepy or dopey or whatever, or both. The report titled "The Drivers of Student Performance: Insights from Asia" surveyed students across several countries in the region. Apart from Malaysia, there was China, Thailand, Japan, South Korea, and Singapore.
Yeah, so in terms of test anxiety, for example, in a study, Malaysia scored 67%, but say students in Hong Kong or Japan scored 78% in terms of test anxiety.
Okay, so what does that mean? So Malaysian students are like really relaxed, they're like, oh, you know, no problem. They, you know, didn't stay up all night long mugging the last minute. They thought, oh, yeah, I'll rely on whatever. I mean, so a lack of test anxiety mean they're very confident that they're going to do well, or that their standards are much lower and they don't really care?
I think if you look at the numbers are not so... I mean, the numbers are close enough. So they're still anxious, but not as anxious perhaps as some of the other peers. Now, I'm sure if you... And this study doesn't look at, say, for example, students in North America. I'm sure that level is probably... But perhaps there could be perhaps more significant differences between
them. Do you think
them.
So? I think the anxiety would be, you know, having somebody burst through your front door of your classroom and shoot you to death.
Oh,
though, you know, I mean, let's be serious. Now, if you're a parent, do you think that if your kid goes into an exam not anxious, that's a bad sign, or do you think it's a good sign? You can always WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM. Tell us if anxiety is something you think is good in the lead up to a reasonable amount of anxiety is actually a good sign that the kid takes it all very seriously.
Yes, so I pulled up some information and you know, in high performing countries like Estonia and Finland, they actually have low test anxiety and very high life satisfaction. So you know, quite in contrast to what you would think in terms of, it's a high-performing nation, but perhaps the Western, you know, Finland is a benchmark in terms of their very different approach perhaps to education.
Yes, so if you look at the scores that we have in this article, Japan, like you said, has very high levels of test anxiety, but their life satisfaction is actually on par with Malaysia. So we have low test anxiety, a lower test anxiety by maybe a factor of about 10%. But in terms of life satisfaction, we're no different from our Japanese counterparts.
Yeah, not only Japanese counterparts, our results are also quite similar to Macau, to Taiwan or Taipei and Hong Kong. So very little difference. Where there is a significant difference with our regional peers is actually with Thailand. So they only have a 60, while their test anxiety score is about the same as ours at 66% versus ours at 67. The life satisfaction wise, they had a 74% percentage versus ours with 61. So they're very happy in life then.
Okay, well, I'm not quite sure how these conversations are happening and what goes into the methodology of this testing. But a lot of people are very interested in how young people feel about the world. And in fact, the government has been on a series of roadshows and I think what they call laboratories around the TN50 project, which is, tested or spoken to thousands of young people to get that their sense of what they want, and perhaps your life satisfaction scores are directly related to your own personal objectives.
Yeah, so I think that frame, it's quite good. I think it's quite commendable that the government is actually actively trying to reach out and find out what young people's aspirations and goals are moving forward.
The question is, you know, how that conversation is being shaped by the state's own agenda, the government's own agenda. Now, in contrast to that, artists are also weighing into this. And there's a interesting play that's going to be on this week. The director and the writer of the play is Mark Tay. He's got a play coming up called Version 2020. Not Vision 2020, but Version 2020. It's a play that's going to be held where he says he's surveyed five young people in order to create this piece of theatre, also looking very similar issues around the desires of young people.
Yeah, so he's, I think, the first Bo Cameronian Promising Artist Award winner in 2002, right? So he's been in the art scene for a very, very long time.
Yeah, he has. So you want to catch that? We're going to tweet out a link to the story that appears in the NST titled Designing the Future. We'll be back with a look at the Women's March over the weekend and attacks on them. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Van Morrison and Moondance. I'm Sharad Kutan, with me, Brian Fernandez. That's a song from 1970. How old were you then, Brian?
That was the year that I was born.
Ah, so you're youngin. I was four. Van Morrison is now about 72 years old, apparently.
Yeah, the longevity question that we were talking about, he's probably still touring.
Oh, is he? Yeah. He probably is. Yeah. Okay. Speaking of being on the march, the Women's March Malaysia took place over the weekend with hundreds of people. Marched from Sogo Shopping Mall to Tugu Tak Raw at Jamek Mosque with the aim to reclaim women's spaces in the public. And their five demands of the march were to eliminate gender discrimination, destroy rape culture and sexual violence, strengthen rights for political space and democracy for all, strive for equal opportunities and wages, and stop the destruction of the environment. That's quite a spectrum there in terms of the demands. Some that seems specifically about women, and others more broadly about humanity.
Yeah. So unfortunately, several participants of the rally were allegedly harassed by a group of men after the march had wound down. Now, so the Women's March Malaysia committee member Yubanishtan Balan told the Malay Mail that their placards were snatched by a group of men who claimed to be pro-government supporters.
Yeah, and some of those individuals who were involved in the harassment actually put themselves up on social media taking credit for their actions, saying that they were patriots, and I believe also they said that the Women's March and those who supported it were trying to bring in foreign elements into our culture.
But Sharad, where is this really coming from? I mean, in this age, we're in the 21st century already, where is this anxiety, this male anxiety coming from?
Yeah, I suspect the 21st century is not going to be very different from the 20th century on very fundamental issues. We already see in China, Xi Jinping now potentially
consolidating power.
Not only consolidating power, he's been doing it for some time. Now he could be president for life. And that, you would think, is a real 20th century move. And it's happening in 21st century China. Now, on the question of male attitudes towards women's rights, I mean, you're a man and I'm a man. And I think on this side of the species divide, there are a lot of anxieties about a loss of privilege. And I think that's often what animates men to oppose the increasing rights of women, their prerogatives, their space, their wages even. That men feel they're going to lose out if women are given equality.
But the thing is, this march towards equality has happened for over decades. Because if you look at Malaysia, for example, women are overrepresented in higher education compared to men. So if I'm not mistaken, the ratio is something like 59 or 58% of women in undergraduate studies people in undergraduate studies are actually women. So men actually are less well-educated now in terms of university education compared to women.
Yeah, and it's not a surprise, all things considered, but there have been over the years, remember, also a pushback. It's like, the alarm bells rang and, certain people in power came out to say, well, this is a situation that needs to be corrected because, the loss of male privilege is a huge thing for men. And, and then the question is that we see, okay, women being highly educated, is that reflected in management, for instance? Our universities where women are overwhelmingly in the majority in the undergraduate population, reflected in the academic positions? Are women leading universities in this country if they're already ahead in the undergraduate game?
Unfortunately, I think if you look at the corporate scene, you will see that women, particularly in some industries, tend to do rather well until they they get to just below senior management, and then they tend to be underrepresented.
And wonder why. Who's created that glass ceiling for women, if not men? Tell us what you think. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. We're coming up to the next bulletin and taking us there, the Seahorses. You can talk to me, BFM 89.9.